Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We're going to start today by talking with my friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. Nearly 6 months after publicly criticizing Cardinal Supich's plan to give a Lifetime Achievement Award to pro-abortion rights senator, a long-serving lay member of the Catholic Conference of Illinois Board of Directors is being involuntarily phased out of his role. Dr. Bunsen has more on this and other church news. Some of the things that we will try to focus on have to do with a partial retrial in a finance case in the Vatican, this particularly by the Vatican Court of Appeal. This has to do with a high-profile London property finance case, but Al followed this some time ago, and it's good that this is being revisited. So Dr. Bunsen will walk us through this. But the other thing that I also want to draw to our attention, as with regard to news, is that Pope Leo has made his official dwelling now the papal apartments within the papal palace, and therefore he is returning to the papal apartments essentially to be in continuity with all of his predecessors, the most noteworthy sole exception being Pope Francis. The return to the papal apartments signals a desire for continuity, but it also will mean a more systematic regulation, if you will, of his safety and with regard to the general security measures that are put in place for the sake of the Holy Roman Pontiff. Now, after speaking with Matthew, we will go on to speak with Thomas Powers. The original vision of the Civil Rights Revolution was to ensure all Americans were protected from illegal discrimination, but unfortunately, it's been derailed by the left's misbegotten disparate impact approach. Are we trending back toward an era of civil rights sanity? Well, this really warrants some serious conversation, and you and I need to talk about this. All this we talk about after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus, and good afternoon, everybody. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, March 19th. It's the Solemnity of St. Joseph. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria University. Your vocational location is at avemaria.edu. The war in Iran is now in its 20th day. President Trump says Israel attacked a major Iranian gas field on Wednesday out of anger without giving the U.S. the heads up. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia's foreign minister says they are losing patience with Iran and its attacks on its neighbors. President Trump says he will not put troops in Iran. Asked about troops during a meeting today with Japan's prime minister, the president said, "Nope, I'm not putting troops anywhere," but added, "If I were, I certainly wouldn't tell you, but I'm not putting troops anywhere." Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard says the U.S. and Israel have different goals in the Iran war. In a House Intelligence Committee hearing today, she said the Israeli government has been focused on disabling the Iranian leadership and taking out several members. Gabbard says President Trump's objectives are to destroy Israel, or to destroy Iran's ballistic missiles, their navy, and mine-length capability. California is seeing its hottest winter day in U.S. history. A Coachella Valley winter weather station recorded a temperature of 108 degrees Wednesday, tying a record set in Texas in 1902 for the highest winter day ever. Las Vegas recorded an all-time March high of 94 degrees, while Phoenix hit 102 degrees on Wednesday. Chuck Norris is in the hospital after a medical emergency in Hawaii, according to TMZ, who says his emergency happened in the last 24 hours on the island of Kauai. The 86-year-old actor is said to be in good spirits. NCAA Men's Tournament is officially underway with a couple of early spoilers. 9-seed TCU kicked things off this afternoon with a close win over 8-seed Ohio State, and 12-seed High Point University pulled off a shocker against the 5-seed Wisconsin Badgers. Just moments ago, number one overall seed Duke surviving a very near upset bid by 16-seed Siena. Number one seed Michigan takes on Howard this evening. And drivers are still seeing prices at the gas pump climb. The national average for a gallon of regular jumped overnight to $3.88, up 4 cents since Wednesday. With your Ave Maria Radio News, this is Bryant Chainley.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. We are going to be joined by my friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and Dr. Matthew Bunsen is vice president and editorial director of EWTN News, and he joins us to talk about church news and current events in light of church teaching. Matthew, it's great to have you with us. How are you?
Oh, great to be with you. It's, as always.
Yeah, it's really good to reconnect with you. So we've got our work cut out for us today, and.
Yes, we do.
I want to start with something that you and I had talked about in private that we sort of expected was going to happen, and that is Pope Leo's return to the papal apartment.
Well, that's right. This is actually it. So I'm glad that you're starting with the fun and good news. certainly, as you mentioned, the headlines coming into the hour. No, you're absolutely right. So it has been a fairly lengthy process of renovation, but Pope Leo the 14th had been really signaled almost from the day of his election, has moved back into the official papal apartments. So it's basically the Apostolic Palace of the Vatican. You know, popes have lived there on an absolutely consistent basis since Pius X, and that goes back to 1903. Pope Francis, as the one very conspicuous exception to that, very famously eschewed living in the Apostolic Palace, and instead remained in the Casa Santa Marta, which is the Vatican guest house, where he stayed during the conclave that elected him Pope in 2013. As you can imagine, we saw also with the pontificate of Pope John Paul II, renovations are needed from time to time. Mm-hmm. They were done in 2005, and after 12 years of being used pretty much only for his weekly Angelus, Pope Francis left behind some work that needed to be done. And that's exactly what's been happening. That work is now finished, and Pope Leo XIV will be able to move into what is his new home and will be his home for the duration, apparently, of the pontificate.
You and I had spoken about this in the past, and so I want to invite you to share not just your salient wisdom, but how tactfully you speak about this. Can we talk about how Pope Francis's decision actually caused some security concerns and even financial strain on the Vatican in order for him to not reside in the papal apartment?
Yeah, so it certainly was his privilege as Pope not to live in the Apostolic Palace. Now, the reasoning that was given certainly was that he didn't want to feel isolated, as can happen in the Apostolic Palace. He was, as time is marching on, a very singularly unique pontiff. And so it probably came as no surprise even then. His decision to remain in the Casa Santa Marta was his right to do as Pope. It came, however, as you know, with certain consequences. The first and most immediate was that in order to keep him safe in what is a very different world now, it basically shut down the entire second floor of the Casa Santa Marta. That meant that you had to bring in security. You needed to close off, basically, a number of rooms, which meant that rather than making money, because people do actually pay to stay there, it's not open to anybody. You can't go on like hotels.com and make a reservation at the Casa Santa Marta, but there are fees that are involved in people who stay there. So that was lost immediately. Then you had the modification costs for the floor. Then you had as well the various other problems that accumulated over those 12 years, including the need for extensive hospital equipment and other things as Pope Francis's health deteriorated. I've seen estimates in the hundreds of thousands of euros that were lost by his decision to stay at Casa Santa Marta. But again, that was his decision to make, and he felt that the cost was worth spending. Pope Leo made the decision then that he was not going to stay at the Casa Santa Marta. Notably, as an interesting side story, in the last near year since his election, he's actually remained where he typically lived, which was a small apartment in the Vatican's Palazzo del Sant'Uffizio, which is the headquarters of the Holy Office, as it used to be called, the Dicastery of the Doctrine of the Faith, but also has a number of private apartments for Vatican officials, which he lived in while he was serving as prefect for the Dicastery for Bishops.
Now, like you mentioned, this is good news that Pope Leo is returning to the papal apartments. We're going to have to go to news that's not so comforting, to say the least, that has to do with the partial retrial of what was once called the trial of the century. So you'll have to refresh our memory what the trial was about, and then let's talk about the retrial.
Well, let's first apologize to everyone in your listening audience, because this is incredibly technical stuff. And if you really like Vatican trials, this is the news for you. And if you like trials in general, this is the news for you. But in for many other people, this is basically legal mumbo jumbo. But the upshot is that the Vatican Appeals Court declared, now there's an important word here, a partial mistrial in what has been a very high-profile case of financial misconduct on the part of Cardinal Angelo Becciu. Now, there's a name that some people will remember, and I think about seven or eight other defendants. It cited in its decision a number of procedural errors by prosecutors in the Vatican trial that led in 2023 to their conviction and a jail sentence for the cardinal on several counts of financial embezzlement. Now, it's a ruling that came down just a couple of days ago, and it's remarkable in the sense that the reasoning behind it is that it basically invalidated many of the aspects of the testimony and investigation that led to the ultimate conviction. So rather, however, than doing two things it did not do. First, it did not invalidate the entire trial. In other words, this wasn't simply declared a mistrial and everything has to start over again. It invalidated certain parts of the proceedings, the original proceedings, and it left in place the effects of the original ruling. So in other words, those are still in effect. So Cardinal Becciu still faces potentially, what, I think, 5 years in prison and $8,000 would be the equivalent of an $8,000 fine and other things. But here's the other aspect, and I think we can touch on this a bit too, is that it has called into question several what are called rescripta, which are papal decrees that were used by the prosecutors to expand their investigative powers in what's called the Office of the Promoter of Justice during investigations. Now, the reason that those have been called into question is because they were not published, and this is where it gets really technical, in a timely manner, and were not disclosed to the defense, or actually were shown to the defense only just before the original trial began, meaning that the defendants were deprived of very crucial information during the investigative phase. Now, this has raised a number of serious questions about what Pope Francis did, not that he's being accused of anything improper, but that the decrees or rescripta that he issued may not have the force of law because of the way they were actually issued, and because of the failure on the part of the prosecution to disclose very important details to the defense.
As a kind of final concern, because we don't want to get over... Oh, now we're out of time in this segment. But just to round off, without getting overtly technical, this yet again signals what started in the Francis pontificate and is continuing under the Leonine pontificate in terms of economic and financial clarity and to ensure that, in this case, legal accountability is upheld. I'm talking with Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. We're talking about church news and current events in light of church teaching. We were just talking about Pope Leo returning to live in the papal apartments and the Vatican Court ordering a partial retrial in what was called the Trial of the Century, a finance case involving London assets. Continuing on the other side of the break, stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Do you feel as though life is flying past you? Are you desperate for a way to find moments of peace and quiet? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian Prayer Series, will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional managers make decisions on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
In her diary, St. Faustina wrote, "If only I had a spiritual director from the beginning, I would not have wasted so many of God's graces. If even the saints needed spiritual guidance, how much more do we?" The nonprofit Revive app lets you meet virtually with certified spiritual companions, scheduling sessions at your convenience, helping you grow closer to Christ. Your first two sessions are free. Download the Revive app today. That's R-E-V-I-V, and then the number 3.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, talking with Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. We're talking about church news. Matthew, to fast forward to yet another piece of news, this has to do with Cardinal Blaise Supich. A critic of Cardinal Blaise Supich, Loyola University Chicago law professor John Breen. What's going on here? What do we know about this?
Yeah, well, if we go back a couple of months, almost 6 months, really, we had the rather significant controversy surrounding the decision on the part of the Archdiocese of Chicago, under the leadership of Cardinal Blaise Supich, to give an award to Senator Richard Durbin, the longstanding Senate Democrat from Illinois, who has quite significantly a longstanding record in the support of things like abortion. And the granting him of this Lifetime Achievement Award really provoked a lot of controversy around the United States among bishops and other things. But one of the more pointed criticisms of the decision came from a member of what is called the Catholic Conference of Illinois, the Board of Directors. Now, for those who may not be familiar, Catholic conferences are basically organizations that assist the bishops of a region or a state in promoting Catholic affairs and giving advice and other things. So they play a fairly significant role, especially in confronting or dealing with things like legislation and activities on the state level. Now, a member of that board was leading that criticism, and his name was John Breen. He's a Loyola University Chicago law professor who had served on the Catholic Conference of Illinois Board of Directors since 2012, and he was, by the reporting of the National Catholic Register, being involuntarily phased out of his role. And that's an important use of phrase, because he's basically being pushed out. Clearly, let's just say it's not voluntary on his part. And the Register was able to confirm the actions of the board, and then also confirmed basically that they reached out to Breen, who said no and provided no further comment when asked if leaving the board was his decision.
The CCI made a statement about Breen's departure. What do we know from that?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. So the board itself noted changes to its governance procedures and said that we recognize the sacrifice of time and talent each member makes and have amended our governance to require a staggered membership cycle for board members. So here we have a board on public policy and made the decision that two of its longest-serving members would be rotating off after 7 two-year terms. Now, the Register is also able to confirm separately that another member by the name of Michael Fitzgerald, who's an accountant, he's based in the Diocese of Springfield, is another lay board member whose tenure is being brought to an end. So the bylaws themselves, and sorry, again, we're dealing with many technical issues today, basically were amended in 2023 so that six lay leaders are selected by Illinois Diocesan Ordinaries for two-year terms, and they can come from any of the dioceses in Illinois. But term limits nor a staggered membership cycle were previously mentioned in the bylaws, nor do the bylaws in any way appear to have been previously enforced. So there, let's just put it this way, that certain changes were implemented, and enforcement of lay board member terms in the first place have led basically to the non-renewal of Breen's membership on the board. So the timing of this coming 6 months or so after the very sharp and public criticism of the Chicago Archdiocese for giving this Lifetime Achievement Award, I think many people would view that timing as somewhat obvious.
As disheartening as this situation is, are there going to be further developments, or will this be as much as we will know about the issue?
I suspect, barring other people coming forward, that this is probably the end of this phase of the story. So we'll just have to see.
Well, then we have to move on then to yet another disheartening situation that has to do with the Iran conflict. And thankfully, it's not just the National Catholic Register has done a lot of good work to shed light on what's happening in Lebanon as well. So what's going on there? Help us understand this.
Yeah, so one of the ways to think about the very significant conflict that is happening in certainly over the skies of Iran and the efforts on the part of the Trump administration to bring down the Iranian Islamist regime is that because of the tendrils of Iran's reach, especially its proxies and the money that it has poured into other organizations. We have the militias, for example, in Iraq. We have Hezbollah, which is a terrorist organization in Lebanon, that they are now also players in what is a mounting regional conflict. The results of that is that we now have conflicts in Iraq, but in particular, we have fighting in Lebanon. Essentially, Hezbollah is at war with Israel, has been for some time. They had already been significantly degraded in the last couple of years by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, as a consequence of Hezbollah's engagement with Israel during the aftermath of the October 7th terror attack by Hamas into Israel. So the group itself had been degraded, but was already in a process of rebuilding, largely with funds and support from Iran. Well, the results of this new fighting are pretty depressing. They're shocking in some ways because it's, we had on UWTN News Nightly just last night the head of the Order of Malta in Lebanon, who was able to been on the ground, and he was reporting that at least a million people have been displaced as a result of this new fighting in Lebanon. And it comes at a time when Lebanon is already suffering from very severe economic problems, as well financial problems, and the lingering effects of war and the massive influx of refugees from neighboring countries like Syria. So this regional conflict, as it continues to grow, is creating some very, very significant problems in Lebanon.
As we continue to assess these regional problems, it's not just Lebanon that's suffering, even though, like you mentioned, it is rather severe there. What do we know about other nations within the region?
Well, we know that in the immediate aftermath of the air campaign on the part of the United States and Israel, that Iran replied by launching massive numbers of what has been accumulating for a very long time of missiles and drones. And the size of the attack, I don't think it took anyone by surprise, because certainly Israeli and U.S. intelligence was well aware of the stockpiles that Iran had of this weaponry. But I think the region was rather shocked when Iran began attacking what had been fairly friendly neighbors all through the Gulf region. So the Gulf states themselves, Qatar and Abu Dhabi and elsewhere, the UAE, all fell under attack. And as a result, too, of these drones and missiles over Israel, you have had many civilian casualties and some pretty near misses. The one that I think was most alarming for Christians, for Catholics, was that elements or parts of a missile landed in or on the roof of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, which for us, of course, is one of the most sacred places on the face of the earth. So the scale of this is something that we're watching very closely, and we need to keep praying for the people of Lebanon, for the whole region.
Thank you so much, my friend, for making the time to talk with us about all these important pieces of news.
Privilege to be with you, really.
My guest has been Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. I share his concern for the regional conflicts of the Middle East. Let us pray for resolution and lasting peace. I'm Marcus Peter.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
Why does the Catholic Church value virginity? At the heart and center of all Christian life is Christ the Lord. The Catechism tells us that our bond with Christ takes precedence over all bonds, familial or social. From the Church's very beginning, there have been men and women who have forsaken marriage to follow the Lamb wherever He leads them. Christ Himself has invited certain persons to follow Him in this way of life, for which He remains the model. Virginity for the sake of the kingdom is an unfolding of baptismal grace, a powerful sign of the supremacy of a person's bond with Christ. It is also a sign that this bond recalls that marriage is a reality of this present age, which is passing away. St. John Chrysostom puts it well, "The most excellent good is something even better than what is admitted to be good." This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
And we need to pray for all our world leaders and all those who are in such danger. See, in a day and age where people are getting further away from God, you get further away from goodness. Only God is good. You remember what our Lord said one day? "Why do you call me good?" He said, "Only God is good. Only God."
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The original vision of the Civil Rights Revolution was to ensure that all Americans were protected from illegal discrimination. Unfortunately, it was derailed by the leftist, misbegotten notion of disparate impact approach. Are we trending back towards an era of civil rights sanity? Thomas Powers joins us. Thomas Powers is a visiting lecturer at the Center for Civics, Culture, and Society at Cleveland State University and the author of American Multiculturalism and Anti-Discrimination Regime, 2023. Thomas, great to speak with you. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much for having me.
I'm really glad to be able to speak to you about this because the thoughts that you express pertaining to the civil rights movement and the direction of our culture since are things that I frequently think about, especially as a minority immigrant individual, just seeing firsthand how toxic the manipulation of the civil rights movement has become. I know that's painting with a broad stroke, but can you tell us what has happened in the United States since the original civil rights movement?
Yes, you mentioned disparate impact, and basically there are, I would say there are three major transformations of the 1964 Civil Rights Act that were not intended or even imagined by anyone in 1964, the first one being disparate impact. And what disparate impact is, unfortunately, a legalistic term that takes a second to figure out, but the basic idea is that originally the idea was discrimination is disparate treatment. If I fire you because you're a minority or a woman, that's treating you differently based on your race or gender, and that's forbidden under the law. But disparate impact is where a practice of a business or some other organization has an unequal outcome. For instance, if I hire people who are over 5'6", that's probably going to discriminate against women in favor of men more often than not. And so that's what they call disparate effect or disparate impact. And that was nowhere, stated in the law. It was discovered by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and by the Supreme Court in a 1971 civil rights decision. And what that did is it opened the door to calling discrimination inequality between groups, period. And unfortunately, the word discrimination is nowhere defined by the law. And I don't want to go on, but there are two other expansions, if that's okay, to talk about that I think are equally important. Would that be okay?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so the other two are harassment and stereotypes I would put together, basically, as another redefinition, and harassment in particular is really wild because it was invented by feminist civil rights lawyers who were trying to expand the notion of what discrimination under the law was against women. And the idea of harassment, in a way, when you see a really bad case of harassment, you would say, yes, that's probably sexual discrimination, and it ought to be banned under the law. But unfortunately, the word harassment is really infinitely expandable, and it extends, by now, it extends under the law to include merely offensive statements, and there's a big debate over that. But basically, what happened then is, and so that's a very big expansion of what discrimination is, that, again, no one foresaw that. No one thought, yes, we need to police how people talk to one another in the workplace or in educational institutions. So that's what happened in 1986 in a decision written by William Rehnquist, oddly enough, a very conservative justice, bought into this idea of feminist law professors like Catherine McKinnon is the famous brain behind this, most people say. And then the third expansion came out of that, because once corporations were suddenly responsible not only for their own policies of hiring and firing and promotion and the like, but now they were responsible for everything that their employees did with one another, whether it was business-related or not, that fell under the heading of harassment. Because when somebody harasses, you sue the employer. You don't sue the individual who does it. And so the employers became responsible for this, and they started to get sued in the 1990s. Huge, $100 million lawsuits, very famous sexual harassment lawsuits started to appear in major corporations in the United States. And so, corporate America kind of turned to the courts and said, look, we got to do something about this, so what should we do to protect ourselves? And the Supreme Court came back in 1998 in a pair of cases nobody's ever heard about. It's called the Ellerth-Farragher test, these two cases that were decided the same day. And in that decision, the court said, if you take preventive and corrective measures, then you'll get some kind of protection in these lawsuits. And so preventive measures include things like policies prohibiting harassment, but also things like diversity training and other sort of looking into the climate of the workplace. And then corrective measures included firing people. And that eventually became very clear in EEOC guidance documents that said termination of employees is one of the kind of corrective measures we're looking for. So those three expansions gave us the woke world that people rebel at, the censorship, the kind of punitive dimension of it. And then that, in my opinion, led to cancel culture more broadly. I don't know. It's impossible to trace out the causal arrows, but it does seem to me that that legal framework played a huge role.
The legal framework paved the way for the eventual ideological and philosophical changes in society. I wonder if you could help us bridge that gap a little bit, because the legal framework created a kind of emotional response in the American populace, and especially the progressivist left.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a very complicated thing, and I think historians, it is amazing to me that more sort of political and social scientists aren't studying this, and historians aren't trying to figure out what happened, because it's sort of like the French Revolution. People will be looking back to this forever, I think, and trying to figure out exactly what happened. It's not just legal. I think the legal aspect played a big role in empowering folks on the left to think that they had right on their side, that they had real measures with teeth in them, that they could, sort of enforce a certain vision, a very aggressive or maybe ambitious vision of what it means to fight discrimination. And this is what it means, and we brook no hesitation or half-heartedness, and we're really going to go to the wall to fight anything that looks like discrimination to us. But there is a moral dimension, and there's an ideological dimension at the same time. And all these things happened at the same time, postmodernism and radical intellectual theories. People like Judith Butler, associated with these ideas. Or I study multicultural education. Multicultural education, if you go back to the 1970s, it was already policy in many states. And it sounds like a kind of middle-of-the-road, not too radical idea. But in the 1990s, that entire field, which is an important subfield within teacher education, they went almost entirely over to postmodernism overnight. And you can see it. You can watch it happen in the journals and so on. And so postmodernism is a very radical set of ideas that in my, I have a chapter in my book about postmodernism and how it radicalizes the commitment, because it unmoors people from reason. I mean, that's very explicit in what they say. They don't believe in reason, and that frees people up to just sort of attack all categories, attack liberalism, you know, the liberal democratic tradition, attack the Enlightenment, attack Western civilization, and in advance, these folks think they know that that's all a bunch of lies. And so I think it sort of appeals to somebody with a revolutionary spirit, but at the core of it is something very pedestrian, you know, civil rights, fighting discrimination, something that's backed by law, something in a certain way is mainstream, that everybody in America believes in. But that combination was very, very powerful. And then you have also the groups that are out there that I don't want to be overly cynical, but different groups on the left associated with different victims of discrimination, women's groups, racial minority groups, LGBTQ groups, and so on, they benefited by pushing this agenda very far. And so they did. And that also is a dimension of the radicalism.
I'm talking with Thomas Powers, visiting lecturer at the Center for Civics, Culture, and Society at Cleveland State University, author of American Multiculturalism and the Anti-Discrimination Regime. And we are talking about precisely this, a new era of civil rights sanity. Continuing on the other side, stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Hello, friends. Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers here. And I haven't been this excited about an up-and-coming speaker for a long time, Dr. Marcus Peter. Dr. Peter has the gift of combining deep theological insight, wisdom, and knowledge with personal testimony and story in a way that makes the power of the church's teaching and God's love felt deeply in the heart of all who hear him. If you are looking for someone for your next conference, parish mission, or event, look no further than Dr. Marcus Peter.
Visit MarcusBPeter.com to book Dr. Marcus Peter to speak at your event. At the Ave Maria website, you can continue the discussion and education through the Ave Maria Radio's links to social media. Ave Maria Radio has accounts on Facebook, X, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and find the social media symbols at the top of your screen.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Steve and Janet Ray here, announcing we are back in the Holy Land, ready to introduce you to our favorite places in the world, the land where God walked. Mass at the most holy sites, pray the mysteries of the rosary where they happened, and experience the Bible in vivid color. We have led over 100 groups through this land, sharing the whole story of salvation. Of all the pilgrimages in all of the world, this is the one you should not miss.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
60 on 10 with Monsignor Charles Pope.
The fourth commandment: honor your father and your mother. This commandment enjoins on us young children not only obedience to their parents, and even older children, great honor for them, but also gratitude for all of our elders, teachers, employers, and leaders. It also directs citizens to a proper love of our country. So it's a rich commandment. And it also puts great requirements on those who are in those positions to be worthy of the honor that is due them. This commandment is fundamentally given to us by God because without respect for our elders, there can be no teaching, and we cannot hand on the wisdom of previous generations. This commandment is rich, and it is for us. The fourth commandment: honor your father and your mother.
For more about the Ten Commandments, visit EWTNRC.com.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking with Thomas Powers, visiting lecturer at the Center for Civics, Culture, and Society at Cleveland State University and author of American Multiculturalism and the Anti-Discrimination Regime. So, Tom, I'm going to pick up where we left off. You were trying to provide for us a very holistic picture of the development of our social mindset into what we can rightly call now, for want of a better expression, woke ideology. But I don't like throwing that term around. So just to refine it based on what you've been sharing, a kind of critical social justice theory that became an overflow of the initial achievements of the Civil Rights Act. I want to ask if you can pick up from there.
Sure. I started to talk. I did mention the groups also that are associated with this movement, and they certainly, if you listen or read, you know, their work, they tend to think that's where everything begins, is with the aspirations and sufferings of these groups, and so that's another way in which you can kind of look at it. It is interesting for me to note that in a way those groups, they certainly existed in a rough sense. But they didn't have the same self-understanding that they did until 1964. Even feminism, if you look at that, in my opinion, feminism, second-wave feminism, is basically anti-discrimination feminism. It wasn't generally true that women saw themselves as victims of discrimination until after 1964. And there's some interesting evidence of that I mentioned, I think, in the footnotes in my book. But another dimension of it is simply the moral force of the Civil Rights Revolution generally. And that's not something that Americans are used to dealing with. And I think that's probably the most important force, and also the source of our great unwillingness to even think or face civil rights politics. The Trump administration has done an awful lot. I've written a lot about that. It's kind of amazing to me what they've been able to achieve. But even they do not talk about rewriting civil rights or rethinking civil rights or reforming civil rights, generally speaking. I mean, they do talk about the need to return to a more sane understanding of civil rights law, and they do appeal to civil rights law all the time. But what we're going through right now, it seems to me, is a reform of our civil rights mindset, and or potentially that's the best thing that will come out of this. But nobody wants to face the civil rights revolution because it unleashed a moral force in American life that, as I say, liberal democratic constitutional politics in a way is about toning that sort of side of politics down. Separation of public and private, not legislating morality, freedom of speech, separation of church and state. All of those strategies have a tendency to try to say, let's not get too utopian in our political thinking. But the Civil Rights Revolution was different from that, and everybody was on board. You know, I mentioned that Supreme Court decision written by Rehnquist that put in place one of the most radical steps taken, the harassment idea. And you see that all over the place. It was a bipartisan effort until very recently, until now. And so those are the main, you know, elements that I would put together is the law, the moral power of civil rights, a bunch of ideas associated with it, and also the groups themselves and how they become somewhat radicalized. And all of those things happen at the same time, and it's probably I end up focusing on the law, but I think it's other people would say, no, it's the groups, or other people would say it's the ideas, you know, and you could probably have an interesting debate about that, actually, because it's very hard to know which of these things came first or which of them was the most important. I tend to think that the law has an authoritative character, uh-huh, and it pushes people in a certain direction. But that's, you know, debatable for sure.
Now, considering all of that, your proposition is also that we might be returning to an era of civil rights sanity, given that we've swung to quite an extreme. You position this in light of the second administration of Trump. Can you please speak to that?
Sure. Yeah, I think what the Trump administration has done, especially with disparate impact, they have taken that down very successfully. And, you know, disparate impact is also connected to affirmative action. I should have said that, I guess, earlier. Disparate impact is an account of what the problem is from the left. Affirmative action is the solution to that problem. Inequalities, what's the solution? Affirmative action. Trump has taken all of that down in a remarkable set of legal legal changes that will be very, very difficult for the left to put back in place, certainly not very quickly. It took a long time for that legal architecture to get put in place. A lot of political energy had to be expended, and now there's very clear opposition to all of that on the right. And so I think that's probably a permanent change. There may be some attempts to put some of it back in place, but certainly not to the extent that that interpretation from the left had legal authority. I mean, Joe Biden, his equity initiative had a whole of government equity plan. Equity was nothing other than disparate impact. He had every agency of the federal government looking for inequalities in the name under the umbrella of equity. And so all of that's gone. The Trump administration has not done as much with harassment and so on, but they did. They just eliminated every DEI office and officer in the federal government overnight. And so that takes out a lot of that diversity training and the manpower to kind of push that side, the cultural side, if you will, of the left interpretation. So I think that's also very important and was very effective. A lot depends on how the right frames this, because to some degree, a lot of people are accusing the right today of being woke right. You know, this is a term that gets thrown around, and there's some evidence that now the administrative state is being used to advance the cause of whites and men and so on here and there. I don't think that's the main thing. I think there is this readjustment and an adjustment to a principle of colorblind equality, colorblind, you know, equal treatment under the law and so on, that is sane. And that does appear in all, you know, many of the Trump executive orders and so on. They do refer to that constantly. I think the government needs to do more to message that, to articulate that. And I think there are a couple other principles that they could use. That's the most important, is to talk about colorblind equality and not to apologize for that. You know, that the left hates colorblindness. The idea of the colorblind ideal for them, that's basically, you know, an inadequate understanding of civil rights and it because it rules out disparate impact. But they also should be talking about our liberal democratic tradition and how the civil rights revolution created many tensions with that. And this is where you start to get into controversial waters, because if you're saying, well, the civil rights revolution in a way is, you know, contradicts the Constitution, what are you saying? You know, and so maybe people don't want to get into that. But I think that is very important also. You know, you think of like Title IX proceedings on college campuses that ignore due process, the many, many tensions between freedom of speech and civil rights commitments. We have to face that. And so I think restoring the importance of our liberal democratic constitutional heritage is a second principle beyond colorblind equality. And then the third prong I would push for would be what I call 1964 originalism. You know, go back to the original intent of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Because if you look at, for instance, Title II of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which deals with hotels, restaurants, theaters, and what we call public accommodations, and segregation of those places by race, that was forbidden in Title II. And people were worried about that. Conservatives were worried about that in 1964 because they said, hey, this is the private sector. Here you have government regulating our social interactions in the private sphere. And, you know, there's something to that maybe. But what happened in practice was overnight that succeeded. The signs that said no blacks allowed or whatever, you know, they came down. And that was the end of it. There wasn't, some kind of nothing grew out of that. In Title VII in the employment sphere, all of those expansions of civil rights from the left that I mentioned earlier, all of that happened in Title VII. And I don't know why. I don't know what that means exactly. But if you go back to disparate treatment and Title VII, the original understanding of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, I think that is more or less like Title II, where everybody would say, yes, we don't want people being fired just because they're black or, you know, not being promoted because they're a woman or whatever. I think everybody in America would think that that's fine. But it's these other expansions of the law that somehow introduced much more radical understanding of what politics ought to be doing into civil rights. And so, yeah, I think there is a vision forward, but somebody has to make the case for that. And it has to be people in government, it seems to me.
You highlighted a tremendous amount of crucial points. One of the chief ones has to do with, like you've been rightly mentioning, and you know, we can couch that under the language of DEI, the overt expansion of application of civil rights principles and legalities. But one of the things you also highlighted is that the progressivist, categorically leftist political view does not allow for a colorblind application of civil rights. Can you speak to that a little more?
Yeah, sure. And then, I mean, unfortunately, it gets a little bit legalistic because colorblindness as a general principle, I think in a way is very easy to defend because it is the original sort of moral foundation of the entire civil rights regime is the idea that discriminating against someone simply because of their race just seems, you know, dumb and, you know, bigotry, prejudice, you know, mindless, something very ugly and not defensible. So that's easy to criticize, but in the law, colorblindness is bound up with certain legal doctrines of the Supreme Court and the application of strict scrutiny, it's called, under the 14th Amendment, which makes it very, very hard for any law to pass muster under the Constitution. So it gets bogged down pretty quickly. And I think what conservatives need to do is to strip away that legalistic aspect of it and defend the moral principles.
Thomas, thank you so much for making the time to speak with us about all this.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Likewise. My guest has been Thomas Powers, visiting lecturer at the Center for Civics, Culture, and Society at Cleveland State University. I'm Marcus Peter.